afraid I'm starting to disintegrate the field again, because this is not a presentation like many of the others presenting new data and new brilliant techniques. It's leaning back a bit and think again about our field, and actually it's about my uneasiness. The first uneasiness is, of course, that the bullets of my sister don't come over in a Microsoft environment, but you will forgive me. Well, this paper is about my uneasiness, and about uneasiness about developments in spatial criminology. And I'm not sure about my diagnosis of what's wrong in our field, and therefore I challenge you to give me your ideas about this. I may be sometimes a bit unkind, because I'm going to say what we do is wrong, and I say, of course, what we do, but I mean what you do. and I like to share my worries about that. So you are here to react on my rumbling. Am I right? Then say what you should do. And if I'm wrong, have mercy on both of you and put me right. Okay, I'll start with some of my history. I saw the light pretty late. It was 2000 before I entered the field of criminology. And I had a career earlier in mathematical statistics. That's where I graduated in, dabbling around somewhat in geography and psychology as well, doing work on rational choice and deterrence and compliance. All these figures don't mean nothing, you may have to understand that. Well, when I entered this criminology field, I felt really quite impressed by the available theories moving around there, and the methods and models that were used, and of course also about much of the empirical work, and especially the great geographical info systems that I'd never seen before were impressive. And then, of course, after some time, leaning back, this is the 7 years itch, I suppose, I thought, well, is this all as nice as it should be? I started wondering whether I'd like to be still married with criminology. And I started wondering whether we as a criminological community are at the right path. And really I ponder, are we making much progress? Not too much in the 7 years that I was around. I really doubt it. And sometimes I even think that we are progressing in the wrong direction. So, this is the grumbling old man's contribution to criminology. And it's therefore not going to be a very well balanced task. I try to issue some of my uneasiness, and I may overstate considerably sometimes to make clear what I'm doing. And I'm certainly not paying due respect to much of the brilliant work that's done in our field. And I like to say that I have truly much admiration for much work that is around, but not today.
I'm just wondering what Richard Burke's murder prediction is saying about this.
Okay, I'm going to play havoc with some of your most favorite research lines, and I'm criticizing the ways and means that often are inevitable. So it's a bit of a double-sided message. And I confess to be a sinner myself. I'm part of the problem, making the same errors that I'm going to point out to you. I'm not going to point to specific studies saying, well, this article of Dr. X is stupid, or Professor Y, what she did was even worse. I may think that when I present some of the criticisms, but I'm not mentioning it. So please overlook my rudeness and simplification for this talk. Consider whether my criticisms have a kernel of truth, and point out if not. So my diagnosis, ooh, there it is.
Back to the rumbling old good move taking it over.
It's a self-propelling presentation. So my diagnosis is that spatial criminology is going the wrong direction, to some extent, and that's because the overemphasis on fancy tools instead of on sound modeling. That's the basis of my diagnosis. And this overemphasis on fancy tools is certainly propagated by the availability of geographical information systems. We have seen quite some nice examples, not to be criticized, of course, there this week. And the other one is the number of very sophisticated mathematical models that are available, especially those that are addressing spatial inference with autocorrelation models. And my idea is that we all have a tendency that if a model is not completely satisfactory, we flight into further complexifying it. And that's indeed the wrong direction I'd argue. Instead of understanding the misfit, we're trying to get rid of it immediately. And I think that if you have a model that's not fitting, you should rethink your model. At least you should rethink your model first before going on by making it more complex.
Do you take questions along the way?
Yes, of course.
Could you define what you mean by model?
Not at all. Not at all. Well, I use the term here in a very generic way, say something, let's have a mathematical model that's predicting or modeling empirical data, and those empirical data don't fit at a certain moment, or the model doesn't fit the empirical data. So think just of a mathematical equation for the time being. I think there's an overemphasis on fit, and that's certainly not unique to criminology, it's a general problem in social science, quantitative social science. A non-fitting model, dear colleagues, is a blessing. Let's be happy when our models don't fit. Actually, if they do fit, I smell something wrong, because usually you have made an error then. But if it's non-fit, try to analyze what's the difference between what your model expects and what your data. It's an opportunity to better understand limitation of models. And I see too often this tendency to say, hey, we have some low R square or whatever we use as a fit measure, therefore put in some extra terms and there we go again. That's certainly not what I like. So do not aim to fit at whatever price. And certainly do not sacrifice simplicity and theoretical anchoring for fit. I hope you recognize that at least some work that is being around is making that error, going on by complexifying models without a good theoretical underpinning. And in that way, we are sometimes hindered by the availability of advanced mathematics. You may think, well, this is a bit an overstatement, and it certainly is, but I'm going to show by presenting two examples what I mean. The first example is an example about introducing real geographical backgrounds in simulation studies. That is the real geographical background. And the second example is an example about advanced spatial autocorrelation models that try to explain what's happening in adjacent areas by referring to what's happening in the other areas. So the first one is about simulation modeling. And if you think 2 seconds about simulation modeling, you are immediately embarrassed. What the hell do we do here? I have here a scheme of 4 possibilities. Simulation is something about actors in an environment that do something, and we have 4 types. We can study real actors in a real environment. That's say the standard observational methodology of science, not to be seen too often in our circles. We can look at real actors in artificial environments. That's putting these actors in a laboratorium situation, or giving the actors a vignette and ask them to respond to that. And actually, you can see a questionnaire is a very thin version of an artificial environment study. The real actor is just asked, would you do this or that, or what is your answer to this question? The third type is the artificial actor in a real environment, and that's what I would call an applied simulation. And an example of that is you simulate police cars running around in a city, and you like to know what is the average time or the maximum time they need to come to incidents. And a lot of simulation work, of course, has been done in that environment, and I would certainly not argue against the necessity of using a real geographical background in a study like that, because it's, of course, not interesting to hear what the police cars would do in a non-existing city, but in a city that you are studying. And the last one, and that's the one I like to give an example on, is a simulation for theoretical purposes. That's where you study artificial actors in artificial environments. An example for that may be a simulation of people, whether they comply or not comply, if they have to react on the neighbors, other citizens that comply or not comply. I'll give you an example of that soon. And it's especially this last one, the simulation for theoretical purposes, that I'm going to argue that coming up with a real geographical background is not that useful. So actually, or to be more precise, in my example, it's on agent-based simulation for theory's sake. And an agent and a theory simulation is really asking what-if questions. What if such and such happens, and what influence might. So it's all about acts, behaviors of agents. Agents are governed by law-like processes, rules, and these processes or rules can specify the act of the actor. We have seen a number of examples this week. And of course, these rules are always dependent on the state of the actors, and also react on the state of other actors and on the environment. Usually, in this type of artificial simulations, this is all done by formulae specifying the choice of the actors. And these may be deterministic or probabilistic, that's not important now. And the problem is, of course, if you have many actors in many states, it immediately starts to become mathematically intractable, defying our skills for analysis, although I have seen with admiration that some of the colleagues from the mathematical side are pretty good in solving all these systems without any simulation. Well, a simulation for theoretical purposes is indeed continuation of analysis by other means, just like war is a continuation of diplomacy by other means. It's really a theoretical exercise. We like to see how all these rules and all these law-like processes interact. So this is not an empirical work, it's a theoretical work. Although you are using a lot of data produced by your computer, you're not interested in the data as representing reality, it's representing theory. A theoretical simulation tries to understand the impact of combined rules by studying the outcomes under various conditions, various varieties of these rules, various varieties of the environment, and so on. At least that's what should be done. And it's just for getting insight in the characteristics of these rules. And you should do it, therefore, only if you're interested in the structure and the impact and the interaction of those rules. And in first instance, it's no claim for reality like this. Of course, you do searching in a, say, large perspective of empirical science. It's not just playing around with these rules. You do this because you like to understand how these rules work, and then later on you may build on these rules that you understand now, empirical models. So it's not an empirical exercise. this is just, it's not for offenders, it's bullet offenders, agents, offenders, target guardians, governor, this is just, I could easily have missed this one. Because it's, this is my example. I'm not going to show you this brilliant piece of simulation, but just give you an idea. This is a society in each cell of the checkerboard. The guy lives, and this guy can decide to comply to a rule or not to comply, and there is a law enforcer around who may audit him, and if he's in error, he gets a fine. And all these people here may see what their neighbors do. Mr. X knows what the neighbors around him have done, and especially whether they have been audited, whether they have been caught, and whether they have been fined. So this is a perceptual deterrence exercise, trying to get hold of how such a simple rule that deterrence is propagated by knowing what the adventures of your neighbors, what's happening. And this is a good example of a piece of theoretical simulation. We certainly don't hold that society is a checkerboard and that all people have only nine or eight neighbors, but we like to see how these rules that von Baal has invented really are making a behavior in this society. All the decisions are rational choice, dependent on the perception of the probability of being caught, and that is propagated through the history in the social network. And I just go very quickly through this. The research question is how this perceptual deterrence is developing over time in such a network as a function of various parameters, for instance, the network size, the actual probability of being caught, the strategies of the law enforcing authorities, and the size of the punishment. Now, we do this simulating because we are not good enough in our mathematics to exercise this through on an analytical base. Now, the model structure, you may have just 5 seconds to see that. It is not very important for our discussion here. It's a completely deterministic decision for the individual citizens, and the only random thing is whether they are going to be audited or not by the law enforcer. And the interesting thing of a simulation of this type is that it gives you insights that you didn't have before. Of course, also very trivial ones. Really, it comes out a higher probability of being caught ends up in a higher compliance and a higher social security as well. But you don't need to do a simulation for that. But also less trivial ones. Something like the existence of the assessment gap in this society. Citizens overestimate the true probability of being caught, which I could not have anticipated from the rules as they were, and we had a hell of a time of understanding why this is happening. And incidentally, we know this from empirical research that it is true in real societies as well. Well, and a lot of other interesting things, and you are going to read that in the book of von Baal, of course, and I'm not going to tell you anything about it. I'm going to concentrate now on whether this theoretical simulation, just as an example of theoretical simulation, is not a model of the real world. Von Baal doesn't believe in a checkerboard world, and he doesn't believe that the perception of probability of being caught exactly follows that strange formula that you could have seen for a few seconds. But we do this because it's a device for research and consequence of simple rules. And it's really about understanding what, how this interaction of these various players ends up in something, and so that we can see what we didn't know, that these simple rules have complicated consequences. Now, the problem is, if you present, if I would present you the results of this simulation, I'm quite sure that it's going to happen. Somebody points out his finger saying, well, you could easily make this more realistic by, and then comes a very good suggestion. It's usually true that are very good suggestions, but they are not welcome in this arena. People may crave for realism, but the realism is not the main point of this type of simulations. Of course we can improve the simulation. Of course we can substitute the checkerboard by something that looks a bit like a real map. For instance, the structure of houses in Amsterdam. We have that available. There is easily to be got data about that, so that we know that all these people have 2, 6, or 25 neighbors. And we know a lot of data about all these houses. And we could, in principle, import it in this type of simulation. But the question is, how easy it may be, is it a good idea? And the answer to that is no, it's not a good idea. Why is it not a good idea? Because we claim that this is a theoretical thing. I'm far away already. Okay, this simulation demonstrates how law-like agents interact in whatever context using the characteristics of that context. I'm interested in how these rules interact, and I'm, in principle, interested how they interact in whatever environment there is. If indeed perception of the probability of being caught is just got from information from your own network, what's happening there? In principle, I should do this for every possible background in order to be sure that they have complete grip on this problem. So, in principle, you should investigate all contexts and compare. And we need to investigate as many contexts as there are. And a real one is not better than a simple artificial one or a complex artificial one. So the idea of, instead of having a checkerboard, having a real map of a real city behind it is not improving the main idea. The main idea is having some insight in how these rules work out. And a real background is not only not better than an artificial background, it's worse. But a real background has its limitations. If I would do this not on a checkerboard, but on the map of Amsterdam, I import the housing density of Amsterdam. And if, say, the density of your network has something to do here, I like to vary the density of the network, which I easily can do in an artificial society. I can't do that in the Amsterdam society, and it's a given density. So in if you come up with a real background, you're really limiting the, your possibility of using simulation. And if you get results on the real map of Amsterdam, it's unclear what characteristics of the many that the real map has influence really the results. So I think that it's not a good idea in general to come up with a better, nicer looking geographical background than this simple checkerboard. And of course, it sells much better. You have no problems if you come up with a simulation on the map of Amsterdam. People stop saying you could easily such and such because they believe it's a real society out there. But that's not, that's just a wrapping up problem. So I think using all these things is, at least in the context of theoretical simulation, a limitation instead of a straightforward. In simulation research, I would prefer other things. I would prefer a more systematic variation of parameter choices. And there's a lot to be said about very good simulation, but alas, what you usually see is some PhD makes a new simulation program, gets his degree, and then it was it. We never use it anymore. And that should not be done, because what usually should be done is running a simulation with number of myriads of combinations of parameters and study them. And I'm very happy that Michael Townsley is trying to to set up a network of simulation guys and going to do that, interchange their simulations so that they can run each other once and then say, hey, I found something very strange in your simulation. And don't mean a program error, but something that you can't understand from a theoretical point of view. And only then, if we are really taking the outcomes of simulation theories and we're going to discuss them, we're going to go forward. So if we have some time left, we should do this, and we should certainly should not fancify our simulations by doing backgrounds. And in fact, this is, I think, an example of a trend, the complexifying trend in large criminological database systems, complexifying things when it's not necessary or too early. And that's, I would say, more is less in this context. Keep it simple. Actually, that's difficult enough. So that is the first half of why we should not make things more complex than they are. And the second example is advanced spatial autocorrelation modeling. What's that? This is a map of some city with a number of areas, and in all these areas, something to be studied. The variable y is present, that's a stochastic variable, or at least I think it is, and a number of explanatory variables as well. And what we try to do in the spatial autocorrelation is say, hey, can we explain this y not only on what's happening in its own area, maybe it's influenced as well on some of these things in the occurring adjacent areas. And there are a number of models available to do that, and this is just a type of generic notation. It is just a regression type model with in which y is only dependent on its own explanatory variables. And if these axes have a spatial structure, then you explain a spatial structure in Y automatically. Say if X is the density of housing, if the density of housing on the west side of the city is larger than at the east side of the city, then you get it automatically into the explanation. You can do that, of course, easily with normal regression things. The second part, that's spatially lagged explanatory, you try to explain the why not only by its own explanatory variables, but also with the explanatory variables that are available around it. So the idea is, for instance, if X is the number of known criminals living in this area, in these areas, and Y is the number of crimes occurring, you may think, hey, there are so many guys nearby, maybe come and do some crimes, let's model that. Well, that's the second one, and of course this is a bit more difficult, but you can still do this with ordinary regression analysis if you have a good design matrix available. And then the third one, and now it starts to become really difficult, is that you try to model this Y. Hey, where's all these? I have explained spatial structure completely. it's not only dependent on all the axes in the vicinity, but also on the dependent in the vicinity away. So it's the y in series 0 is dependent not only on the dependents, but also on the dependent variables around that. And that's called spatially lagged dependent variables. And somehow or other, people are very, they like this type of models. And well, you can't do this, but in normal, within a standard regression model, you should do this with something more difficult, but all the software is all the same. So the first approach is near areas are similar because their explanatory variables are similar. And the second one is near areas are similar because they depend on each other's explanatory variables, which may be autocorrelated themselves already. That's called a mutual influence model. And it's slightly more difficult, And the third one was near areas are similar because their dependent variables are correlated. There's a lot of problems about the underlying probability spaces in these things, and I tried to write a paper on that somewhere else. Well, and this is the formal notation if you really like to become more exact. But my point now is, if we have some data and we are going to analyze that, there should be a reason to choose one of these, and that reason should not be that this one is not fitting enough, and this one a little bit better, and this one still better. As a matter of fact, all these models are nested within each other. So the third model is always better than the second model, is always better than the first model. And therefore, there is this automatic trend that people start to try to take model one, and if it's not fitting enough, go to model two. If that's not fitting, go to model three. And that's a trend I don't like at all. It may be a good idea, but only if we can understand the differences between this model. But you automatically import a quite different type of explanation of the example. And what you now and then see is that people just do this in an automatic loop without studying why the extras in going over to the more complex model should be taken on. Can the parameters substantially be interpreted? A misfit is not the same as the need for a more elaborate model. I say that misfit is the need to think again. And so every step here is not a step that you just pull the handle again and there comes the new version of your output. It does. It really does. These programs are brilliant and they come with some answers, of course. But you should think before you are interested in these answers. So every more elaborate model should allow interpretability of all extra elements. And there must be an underlying process identified in the content terms. So, and I'm a bit afraid that we often don't see that. I'll just very quickly give you an example of this. The data are from Wim Bernasco and Fleur Lux. The fact that I'm going to criticize the use of this data has nothing to do with their analysis. This is a different analysis using their data, and they were brilliant. They didn't make these errors, but I'm going to use the data to show us. The dependent is the burglar rate in the neighborhood. This is the city of The Hague in the Netherlands. The explanatory variables are area affluence, all personality, home ownership, and real estate value. The area social disorganization in terms of residential mobility and ethnic heterogeneity. And there is something called the burglar density, the known burglars living in that area. Well, and this is the first model. Well, actually, there are three models, but it's all on the first approach. This is the zero model, and we compute an index of spatial autocorrelation. There is indeed spatial autocorrelation. There's something to explain, and we start explaining that just by trying to incorporate the axes on the areas themselves. First, the desorganization part, and then the wealth part, and indeed, we succeed in explaining away quite a lot of the spatial autocorrelation. And you see here a nice model that makes the spatial dependency in the dependent completely understandable because it's a function of the independent and the independence themselves. Already the spatial structure. Now, okay, in principle, and this is, I guess, what the original authors published, and they did something more, which I don't give you here. I could go say, I'm not satisfied enough, this is not nice enough, I will see more. I go on to this second approach. The second approach was that the dependent was not only explained in terms of its own variables, but also of the variables in the surrounding areas. And I start now with this one, and this one are not quite related. because I'm now going to look at the burglar density. Burglar density may indeed explain quite a lot in the dependent variable, because what it was first a heavy autocorrelation goes down. So indeed, looking at some explanatory variables in the adjacent areas is a good idea to get some fit. And of course, if you believe that burglar density in the surrounding areas is driving the crime process in an area, you have a theoretical underpinning for that. You can, of course, discuss that or not. If you now quite automatically just had taken this model with the axis and then added the burglar density, something completely different occurs. Certainly this one is not so important as this one. And I think that this is a good example of why thinking first before you just augmenting a new variable with a new structure, tapping in to the values of the adjacents, is not a gratuite operation. You should think about that. And the third one, because I had explained away all correlation is not necessary, but I could do it. Say, hey, if I just use also dependency of the variable around, actually I'm always at a loss what I should think about that. It really is working. But my point now, I iterate that, is that in many cases, the complexifying of this model, you have three different types, with really three different underlying processes, are used as in Dutch say, a kip zonder kop, which means a beheaded chicken. And we shouldn't do that. Don't analyze your data as a kip zonder kop. Analyze them as a human being. Well, in fact, all these three things increase the fits pretty nice, but it decreases the interpretability, it decreases the understandability, and the stability of the outcomes as well. I didn't show that, of course. And things become even worse when we use the spatial lag inference that's different on space. I just had one area with six around, but I did it, of course, for the whole city of The Hague. And it's very easy in these models to specify that the dependency of all these y variables on the y variables in the surrounding may be different in different areas. It's just a push the button of the machine and there it comes. I have no idea who to interpret this in general. It's possible mathematically to do it, and it's been solved in the programs by from Anseline and others. But the interpretation is so difficult, I would say, that I have never seen any substantial interpretation of such a model. And I'm very much interested to see one. And the fit is better, the interpretation is awful. So I think we should only use this type of models if a theory-based model accounts for the incorporation of this extra type of inference. Well, there's an analogy that I like. Lissero models with correlated errors, Lissero structural equations. You have a nice factor analytical model. It doesn't fit quite, and you then come in with some correlated errors. There was a very nice Lissero model here, but you can't see it. So we have to do that without that. And just correlating errors is, in my idea, not so good. And that's in a different field of criminology a good example. So, summing up, I really prefer a misfit in a model. I prefer misfit in a model much over a model that I can understand over a fitting model that I can't understand. Thorough analysis of where the misfit is located is much more important than a better fit. And adaptation of all these area-based explanatories go the same way. Only if I can understand and really believe the underlying process. I will go reluctantly only for these lag models if I can interpret that Lex is the within the theoretical model, and I challenge everybody who uses this type of analysis to do the same. So using all available mathematical and graphical machinery may be counterproductive. I will say it will not always be counterproductive, but I'm close to it. So think twice before you let yourself be seduced by all this nice apparatus. It's there, and you can understand that for some very special problems it may be useful, but that's not always the case. Better fit is not always better understanding. So, final remarks, two examples. One in which I say, hey, if we import geographical background, things become worse. The other one is if I import fancy spatial autocorrelation models, things maybe go worse. And I have, of course, to say that there is very well possible, and there are, of course, also in literature examples, splendid work in the criticized traditions. And it is not the case that I have once and for all broken with all these things. There are, of course, good examples possible, but you have to do your homework and convince me that these models are better than their simple non-fitting colleagues. And I apologize to those anonymous colleagues that did the group work, and as well to the others. So, criticism, questions, remarks.